It's the News Roundup, where we discuss the region's top stories of the week. And joining us this week, Ann Brennan, Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times. Morning, Ann.
Morning, Mindy.
Well, President Obama gave his inaugural address this week, and Cape Codders responded to that mostly with optimism.
Right. This was a column that Sean Gonzalez wrote. He talked to different people around the Cape about, you know, what did you think about, you know, their reaction. Tom Kerr of the Cape Cod Regional Transit Authority was saying he was very encouraged that Obama continues to talk about increasing transportation, that he says this is what makes a modern economy viable and helps economies grow. But yet he says, you know, there's a difference between setting this and authorizing this and the Congress appropriating money for this. So he was optimistic about that. He likes seeing that continuing.
Yeah, of course. How do we pay for it? Sounds great, but how do we pay for it? And of course, before we move on to the rest, of course, here last week we talked about Governor Patrick's plans to, raise income tax and lower sales tax, and part of that is to put to transportation. So,
well, if you look at what and Tom Kerr has been part of this, they've been able to get now an MBTA train that's going to come down on the weekends in the summer. That's possible because we have more RTA buses on the street. Mm-hmm. Before, it was kind of a dicey proposition when you got here.
How would you
get around, right? You know, other than rent a car. So it does bring people more down. More people down, they can get around, and that's the whole economic point he's trying to make.
Yeah, and of course, and all the transportation officials here getting together now on a regular basis.
Right.
Tom, and then we've got the air folks, people, we've got the
buses.
Yeah, everybody sort of
ferries.
On the same page, trying to figure out, right, when we get people here, how do we connect them to where they want to go? Because we want them to leave their cars home.
Right, and come and have a good time.
Exactly.
And be able to get around. So he was encouraged by that. Another person Sean talked to was David Darling of East Sandwich. He's a retired Kansas State University economics professor. He said that he was watching the speech from the perspective that he wanted to see things that unified the country. And what he meant by that was more in an economic basis, rules to ensure competition and fair play in a free market, which Obama talked about. And he sees that, you know, things like revamping the tax code, reducing the cost of health care and the size of the deficit. He's saying that he supports all that. And those are things that he says on an economic basis kind of can bring people together.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we have, as you said before, a lot of financial problems still ahead,
right,
huge
sure.
deficit, and how you pay for all this or bring the cost of it down. That resounded to him. Another person Sean talked to was Barnstable Superintendent of Schools, Mary Chakowski. Did I say that right?
I think so.
She was encouraged. You know, again, Obama, since he has been in office, has made education a big issue, not unlike George W. Bush. The whole push towards the so-called STEM curriculum, science, technology, engineering, and math, Chakowski saying, that's great, but I'm glad he's continuing to support this, but we need to get that curriculum down into the elementary schools, mm-hmm. and so that kids are getting this all the way through,
right.
Which, Mindy, we are of an age that, mm-hmm. In the race to the moon, we had a lot of this type of curriculum when we were kids,
right.
in elementary.
And it went away,
Right. And then you saw, Silicon Valley and other things. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so she's encouraged by that, but she said, there is still an issue of economic diversity, that there are kids who come from very wealthy homes in Barnstable and kids who come from very impoverished homes. Often the kids who are more impoverished have not had, this kind of surprised me. I know in Massachusetts, there's no law that you have to send your kid to kindergarten. So there are kids coming into first grade in Barnstable who haven't had any preschool and had no kindergarten. And kindergarten these days, we played blocks and,
A little bit painted. More than that now.
My daughter, it was 20 years ago. Well, not 20. Yeah.
Almost.
Almost. she had homework in kindergarten.
Right.
You know, they were expecting them to not just know the ABCs, but start to learn to read. So kids coming into the classroom having had zero education experience really put them behind,
yeah.
right
Big
from the start.
Yeah.
So she's saying she'd like to see more early education, and hope that comes along.
Right. Right. Well, in other news, Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station shut down earlier this week. This is the second unexpected shutdown this month.
Right. This has to do with a safety relief valve. Well, just, you know, how the plant works. You've got the reactor heats up water. Water turns into steam. Steam runs the turbine to generate energy. And then that steam is pushed through condensers to turn it back into water, which then is reheated. In an effort to make sure, as a safety system, that if the pressure of the steam builds up, there are safety relief valves that open in the case of an emergency. And in doing some maintenance testing, they found that this valve wasn't working, and so they had to shut the plant down. And as you said, it's the second time this month and the sixth time in the last 2 years. Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station exceeds industry standards for automatic shutdowns. When an automatic shutdown, by the way, there's one that you can shut it down slowly, mm-hmm. and then the automatic shutdown or immediate shutdown is much harder on the plant. Mm-hmm. So the NRC and others don't like to see those types of shutdowns. So it exceeds the averages for shutdowns in the industry, but not to the point where it needs to have more NRC inspection or oversight.
And of course, the big question is here. They just got relicensed, and that was a big question. This plant is 40 years old, and I know Senator Wolf was talking about look around our homes. How much, 40-year-old technology do we have? So it's a good question. You can see where it raises some questions. But even though, they say everybody was perfectly safe and, they fixed the problem, but, it does make you wonder.
Well, and it was the second safety relief valve issue. Mm-hmm. So they apparently took the one that when it happened previously, about a year ago, I guess, they took the valve and did an evaluation and couldn't figure out why wasn't it working.
Yeah.
So also
this week, Falmouth Selectmen heard 2 hours of comment from people on the 3 options presented to the Selectmen on what to do to mitigate complaints related to the town-owned wind turbines.
And these people are, before these 2 hours of talking, there was a protest of people standing in 16-degree weather saying that
you got to be pretty committed to your cause
to stand in
that kind of cold.
Down. Yeah. But yes, this was that group that came together, the Falmouth Wind Turbine Options Analysis Process, where they brought everybody together from different points of view to figure out, what are we going to do? The 3 options include run the turbines without curtailment, curtail the turbine operation, or replace the turbine with solar panels. And then, as you said, the selectmen presented these or had a hearing about these, there were 2 hours of mm-hmm. people commenting. And bottom line is people can't agree.
Right. Well, this is such a difficult situation because, we had most of the people, were, for taking the turbines down. But Richard Latimer, who spoke at the board, said to take turbines that we put up perhaps foolishly and spend additional money to take them down and end up with nothing is folly. He is advocating that they take the surrounding properties by eminent domain. He says, is this harsh? Yes, it is. But it would be equally harsh to the voters and taxpayers of Falmouth to ask them to spend money and take a loss. So, did we put these up foolishly? Maybe yes, maybe no. It depends on who you talk to. But the impact of this is just, you've got these people who, if I was a homeowner there, I'd be pretty upset. People are saying that they have all this noise, they can't sleep, they're having health problems. It's not like they can up and sell their house and move away because who buy? If you're not going to buy into a neighborhood like that. And then if they take it by eminent domain, are they getting fair market value? All these questions that are still swirling. It's a tough situation to be in.
Well, at a time, too, where you have questions of climate change and the necessity to move to alternative energy sources. So it's a tough, you say.
And a lot of people are saying, well, can't we take it down and put up some kind of a solar installation, I guess all this controversy over wind turbines done a lot for the solar industry. And more people are turning to that. But it's and what does it cost to take it down and who's going to pay for it? It really speaks to that. We need to have the, you know, citing regulations and know what we're doing before we put these things up.
And the different types of turbines, too. I understand there's some that are more quiet than others, but then to that take care of the flicker, which people say is affecting their health. So it really is a thorny situation.
Right. And then the selectmen didn't take a vote on this at their meeting, but they are accepting written public comment until Monday at 4:30 if anybody else wants to chime in on that. So we'll wait and see what they decide to do. Well, here's a story that surprised me. You would think one of the businesses that would always have customers would be a funeral home. Nantucket's only funeral home is struggling to survive.
Right. This is principally because people are opting for lower cost cremations rather than the more expensive, you know, burials. Mm-hmm. The industry in general has seen that trend. And this, the Lewis Funeral Home, which has been in business since 1878.
Wow.
The owner now is 78 years old. He'd kind of like to retire. But one of his relatives who's getting training to become a funeral director is wondering if it's worth it because there are people who can't afford to be buried or have a funeral, and the funeral home has been kind of absorbing that cost, about $200,000 over the last few years. So they're saying, okay, well, maybe we should sell it, but the cost of because the business isn't making as much money and the cost of real estate on Nantucket is so high, anybody coming in to buy it would have to have a mortgage mm-hmm. and would have a very difficult time making it business-wise right. because there's no mortgage now and they're having trouble making it.
Right. And so they typically handle between 50 and 70 deaths annually. When you think about this, I mean, it's tough living on the island to begin with.
Right.
You know, you have to go off. I mean, a lot of, even though we have doctors and things, some specialist things, you have to leave the island for that. You have to leave the island for so many things. It would just seem so odd to have to leave the island to deal with a death.
Right. Well, if you wanted to have a burial, they, like you say, they would have to leave the island for the body to be embalmed, then return the body back to the island for the church service. That really, you're starting to talk expenses here.
It's very expensive to begin with.
Winifred, we actually were looking into this for another project at the paper, and you know, funeral directors told us that a lot of people no longer have life insurance, mm-hmm. and that was often what paid for funeral expenses, and just like the people are opting for the cremations rather than the full burial.
Right.
I mean, a funeral can cost between $8,000 and $10,000,
if you're lucky,
000,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, right.
At this point, you know,
and even with the cremations, this was something when my mother died, I learned this. You still have to buy, you know, whatever kind
right.
of whether it's a, you know, a expensive coffin or a pine box or whatever, you know, you still have to buy that. They still, you know, there's still a cost factor involved.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing is that the funeral homes, like in the case of Lewis, is that they would take care of the opening the grave and
mm-hmm.
stuff. Now the cemeteries are doing it. So sometimes people are opting, rather than going through the funeral home, having the funeral home place the obituary, people are coming to our paper
mm-hmm. and doing
personally.
Yeah.
So you're seeing that there's a lot of things going on in this industry that are shifting. And you have a business on an island that's trying to survive.
Wow.
And so they're Kelly Miller, who is the apprentice funeral director, is saying she's in school and she's thinking,
can we make this work?
Is this a good thing to be going into? They have asked the town if they're interested in doing some kind of nonprofit,
mm-hmm.
Maybe run it as a nonprofit. The selectmen apparently went into executive session and came out and said they weren't interested. There's also talk of maybe having an indigent person fund so that there would be money to pay for the funeral services
it, yeah.
who can't afford it. And in next town meeting, there'll be a non-binding article in the town in April that asks whether the town should set up a nonprofit organization to purchase and run the funeral home. In addition, there's a second article that would be a home rule petition to request an exemption from the state law that requires funeral directors and embalmers to own a stake in the funeral home.
Mm.
So we'll see if that
yeah.
goes through.
Got more to come, yeah, on this
right.
one. Well, a number of dogs in Wellfleet have fallen ill over the last few months, and some kind of poisoning is suspected, but no one really knows for sure what the cause is. But I guess the experts here are saying they don't think it's intentional, whatever it is. But how odd, dogs on different sides of town. It's not even in one area.
Right. The, like you said, five dogs have become ill, and unfortunately one had to be put down. All these dogs went to the vet. They did take blood work, and they did find that there was a toxin or poison in their blood, but it could be something that they got into, such as antifreeze, which apparently is pretty sweet smelling, and it doesn't warn dogs off. May have been spilled on the ground, or they also think there may be something natural if a dog drinks stagnant water. But they do feel, the police chief and the dog officer are saying, we don't think anyone's going around poisoning the dogs, but one thing that seemed to be a common thread was that these dogs were allowed to run free. They weren't always, you know, the owners would let them go out.
And, although there was one, though, back. That Jay said that wasn't ever off the leash. So that's puzzling.
Right.
Yeah.
So
who knows?
Yeah. Right. Well, they wanted to put this warning out to people to say, we don't think anybody's poisoning these dogs, but you might want to keep an eye on where they're going and where they are and what they're ingesting.
Yeah, and it would be interesting, that, and I'm sure probably they're checking this out, but if these dogs happen to walk in any of the same areas, you know, it'd be interesting to see. Because I know they lived on different parts of town, but sometimes people bring their dogs to the same, you know, walking trails and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and could be something there. Who knows?
Right. Well, they did kind of say that part of the reason they think that it wasn't somebody doing this was because that the dogs were from different parts of town. But maybe you're right. They do go to a common place.
Right. And I guess for one of the – well, two of these dog owners happened to be in the vet's office at the same time talking about their dogs and went, hey, wait a second. That's my dog is having the same – you know, sort of compared notes, which might have sort of alerted people that, hey, there's you know, there's something going on. And this was not just like – it was since the summer.
Right.
Yeah. So.
And, you know, there's some of the symptoms, you know, like one of the dogs couldn't walk down the stairs. Another one seemed like he was drunk and even let the much detested cat rub against his leg.
You know something's wrong with him.
And then a Pomeranian that didn't respond to the snap of fingers, and her back legs were limp. So that's some of the things to look for. But also.
And then there was a bigger dog, a lab, who was dehydrated and owner said abnormally cold, was kind of spacey and stumbling. But there was no vomiting. There was no diarrhea, no signs of a seizure. He had no blood work abnormalities, no signs that he'd ingested antifreeze. He recovered after being on fluids overnight. So,
The veterinarian did say, we do think that there was some kind of toxin involved with
what
this.
It is, they're not
and
necessarily
it, like
sure.
we said, it could have been, they're saying it could be natural. It could be stagnant water. It could be, you know, chemicals in the water that are used on roads.
Ran off from something.
Yeah.
Be careful out there, I guess. Well, we've seen some early arrivals of right whales in Cape Cod Bay, a mother and calf among them. And I guess that wasn't off Plymouth, but there's been some concern about cold temperatures and how the whales are faring. It's a little bit, especially with that little one.
I know. Well, this baby right whale was born in Plymouth Harbor, it's about 3 weeks old. Earlier this week, it was spotted in Plymouth Harbor with its mother. And that's extremely rare. Mm-hmm. Most of the births happen off of the coast of Florida and Georgia, where water temperatures are about 61 degrees. Plymouth Harbor is about 41 degrees right now.
Colder.
And so, but the you know researchers, the Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies and others are saying that they went out and took a look at the pair. And actually, the mom's name is Wart. She's known to them.
Mm-hmm. About 40 years old, 40-something.
40 years old. And that they both look like they're in good health. With the waters cooler, the danger is, I guess, their energy. Like the mom has enough blubber to keep her warm, but babies don't have quite as much. The blubber also helps the mom nurse the baby. So they're just saying the mom's probably going to have to produce a lot of milk to keep the baby energy up. Yeah. The good news is they tested the area for zooplankton levels, which is what adult whales eat. And there's plenty of that. Although right whales don't usually eat while they're nursing their young, but if her blubber does become depleted, there is
feels a
little
source. Down, needs a snack.
Yeah,
yes, right there. Well, I guess we should say why she's no expert. I mean, this was sort of a success story because she had gotten entangled and was rescued. I guess she had pretty bad entanglement from what we hear. Yeah.
She had a calf in 2005 named Blackheart, and then they started seeing her in 2008. Like you said, she was entangled in a rope, and in 2010 they were able a team from the Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies were able to use a razor device they call a gobbler or guillotine to remove the rope from her. But there were real concerns about her health at that point. And so, as you say, now they see her and she has a baby.
Yeah.
And I have to say that, you know, the North Atlantic right whales are extremely endangered. They're saying there's less than 500. A few years ago, we were saying less than 300.
350, yeah.
This birth is, I guess, the 16th of the season.
And when you think about it, had she not survived that entanglement, we wouldn't be talking about this little baby whale right now. So, and more to come. I mean, it's interesting. Yeah, we saw before Worth, there have been a few others that they've spotted in the bay, and was like the earliest I think they've ever seen them. So it's interesting that you mentioned that device, the gobbler guillotine. The Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies, Stormy Mayo and the group there that work on the white whale research, they invented a lot of these disentanglement, you know, gadgets that they use along the way as they've, you know, gotten experience with different types of situations. So I wonder if this is one of the ones they invented.
Well, and they know the thing that's interesting to me, too, is how they know these individuals and track them. They do want to go out again. They were out, you know, like I said, they took they put cameras in the water and saw the pair, like, in 25 feet of water swimming around. But they want to go back out and see if they could get some scrapings off the baby's skin to determine the sex of the baby, as well as who the parents might be, who the father might be, I'm assuming DNA.
Yeah, we'll have to keep our eye on that. Well, a resolution to make the annual shark tournament on the Vineyard all catch and release will be on the April town meeting warrant in Oak Bluffs. This has been a bit of a controversy for many years.
Right. This is the Monster Shark Tournament, which has been going on, I think, for like 26 years, is a tournament that draws a huge number of tourists to Oak Bluffs. But there's a group of people who feel like, you know, the whole bringing in bloody sharks and hanging them up and the rowdiness involved with that is not in keeping with, you know, how they view their town. Mm-hmm. So they have they collected enough signatures. I think it was about 450 signatures to put a non-binding a warrant on the town meeting. Meeting warrant that would, it doesn't really have any legal teeth.
But it says what the town wants. You know,
right. So right now, when people catch sharks in the shark tournament and they pay almost $1,500 to do this, be in the tournament, about 98% of the sharks are caught and released. There's information that is taken about the sharks that are caught and then released because this also provides a scientific research opportunity for shark folks in the state.
And Greg says they do learn a lot of information from this. Yeah.
About 2% of the sharks are brought back to shore. What this group wants is that it become a complete catch and release tournament, that no sharks be brought back to shore. Those sharks that are brought back to shore are usually dead. Mm-hmm. Again, the researchers look at them. They might do some necropsies as well and measure them, weigh them, brings information. But you have those visions, those pictures, those images of these sharks hanging upside down with blood all over them. And they're just saying, we don't want that. The tournament folks are saying, well, people aren't going to come if they can't come and see the sharks.
If
they can't see the sharks, that's going to hurt tourism in the town.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how the vote goes.
But the bottom line is the state regulates it, not the town. So even if they do that, it would have to be, there's like no legal needs to make it a catch and release totally. But it is a way of saying this is, we don't want this.
I didn't realize 98% were released. So
I didn't realize that either. Yeah.
Well, interesting find beneath the floorboards of Antarctic explorer Ernest Shackleton's abandoned expedition base.
Right.
Well, it's like you hit the jackpot here, sort of, if you like scotch.
Right. There was a few cases of whiskey as well as some brandy, which makes me wonder, if you know anything about the Shackleton Expedition, how much they took to begin with. So this was found in 2010 by people who are doing research in one of the huts that was used by the Shackleton Expedition. Just quick recap, it was an expedition that left England in the early 1900s to do an expedition to Antarctica. The waters around Antarctica froze, breaking up the ship, leaving everybody stranded. And in the end, it's a good news story because they used the smaller boats that they had to, I think it took about a year or maybe two, to get to the place where they could get rescuers to come and pick up the people who were stranded, and no one died.
Right. So that's good news. Yeah.
Right. So there
it's all that scotch.
Right. Well, that's what I'm wondering. If you're one of those people who was waiting for a year for somebody to come back. Anyway, this was whiskey that was found under the floorboards of a hut that was used by the expedition. They took the company that now owns it. It's the White & McKay own the McKinley brand, which is the kind of whiskey, McKinley whiskey. They didn't have the recipe for this particular whiskey, so they were able to get a couple of bottles of from the Shackleton archaeology site and flew it to Great Britain. They used a syringe to take remove some of the whiskey, which, by the way, never froze.
That's amazing. Never froze. I say alcohol doesn't freeze, but I think maybe in some temperatures it might. So they were able to, and so they flew the scotch back, though.
Right. They flew it back, and they're going to be returning it to the archaeological site or the site of the hut. And they're going to make 50,000 bottles of this whiskey, which they will then sell. And about 5 pounds of the sales will go to the conservation efforts for the Shackley site.
I love the New Zealand Prime Minister, John Key, who said he personally returned the stash, and got a taste of the contents of the bottles of the whiskey, which were discovered, of course, 102 years after the explorer was forcibly left behind. He said, "I think we were all tempted to crack it open and have a little drink ourselves now."
Right.
But somehow they managed to
get those. Well, and the woman on the archaeology dig was saying, whiskey was such a nice smell compared to the other things, like, you know, things that were decaying and stuff that didn't smell quite as good.
All right, Anne Brennan, Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times. Thanks, Anne.
Thanks, Mindy. Stay warm.
I say bundle up, cold temperatures into the weekend. Maybe a little bit of snow tonight. Dan says, an inch or two. And if you want to get some summer, photos of summer on the Cape Cod Times website, and we can, you know, think ahead.
Yes.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening. The Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. Amy Vince produces The Point. Mindy Todd is executive producer. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.